which was true, and Flash's purchase hadn't really been paying for fish. It did offer at least a threadbare excuse if anyone from Dolar or Harchong should ask questions, since the fishing boat skipper could always explain he'd had no choice but to hand over his catch when a 10-gun Carizian schooner sailed up alongside and suggested he do so. In fact, he'd been looking for Flash, or one of Manthir's other ships, expressly to sell them his information. Which, under most circumstances, would have made Manthir extremely suspicious. But this particular fishing boat was one of the regulars on Dolar Bank, and during the squadron's tenure on Trove Island, its skipper really had sold them a lot of fish. Like most common-born Harchongese, he prayed daily that God and the archangels would keep the officials of the Harchong bureaucracy safe, well, happy, and far, far away from him. And that had made the Trove Island base one of his favored ports. He got a far better price for his catch from the Carizian squadron than he was ever likely to get elsewhere, and he wasn't compelled to pay the customary rake-off to the harbormaster and half a dozen other minor officials. In the course of their discreet transactions, he and Manthir had met several times. In fact, the admiral had made a point of sharing an occasional glass of whiskey with the man. And something a bit closer than a purely professional relationship, yet too distant to dignify with the description of friendship, had sprung up between them during those meetings. Manthir never doubted that the fisherman was as canny as they came. He had to know that the real reason for a foreign admiral to hobnob with the skipper of a lowly fishing boat was because the admiral in question was deliberately cultivating information sources. The interesting thing had been his clear willingness to be cultivated. Given how many reasons low-born Harchongese had to dislike their own aristocracy and the corrupt bureaucrats which served it, a certain willingness to do those aristocrats and bureaucrats a disservice was understandable enough. Doing the same thing to the church, however, was quite another thing, yet Manthir had come to the conclusion that the skipper had reasons of his own for doing exactly that. So no, he wasn't prepared to disregard the man's information and implicit warning. That didn't mean he was prepared to accept it uncritically either, but it did fit rather well with the other bits of information he'd been able to assemble. And it would be an eminently reasonable way for Thirsk to proceed.
"You've singed their beards pretty well at Yushai," he told himself, still watching the ominous wall of purple-black cloud marching towards him. "And Langhorne only knows how many thousands of marks worth of naval stores and artillery you've sent to the bottom. But if Thirsk really has that many ships at sea, it probably is time you headed for home. And it's for damn sure you don't want to get blown any deeper into the gulf than you can help."
The problem was that he might not have much control over where he got blown to.
"All right, Rafe," he said, "I don't think this is going to get any better, and I'd just as soon none of us got dismasted in the middle of the night by something we couldn't see coming."
"Oh, I think I could live with that, sir."
"Good." Manthir bared his teeth, then grimaced. "I smell a lot worse than this. Pass the signal while we've still got light enough. Send down the upper yards. Then I want the royals and the topgallants housed and storm canvas ready."
Miguel raised one eyebrow. Manthir obviously did expect the weather to get a lot worse. Either that, or he was suddenly becoming far more timorous than Miguel had ever seen him before. He glanced back at the ominous western horizon and decided the admiral had a point.
"Yes, sir. I'll see to it at once," he said.